Hi, this is Sarah. If you like this episode of Let's Talk About Sects, you can listen to my audiobook, Do As I Say, How Cults Control, Why We Join Them, and What They Teach Us About Bullying, Abuse and Coercion. The audiobook will be available on Audible, Apple Books, Google and Kobo from the 28th of June. A link is in the show notes.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Sarah Edmondson is an actor, voiceover artist, and activist who spent 12 years in Nexium, rising from student to coach to eventually running her own centre in Vancouver, Canada. After becoming involved with its secret society, DOS, she managed to escape and, alongside her husband, Anthony Nippy Ames, became a whistleblower on the cult and worked with the FBI to expose Keith Raniere's crimes. Today, Sarah and Nippy make the fantastic podcast A Little Bit Culty, in which they speak with some incredible guests, including other former cult members and experts in cult dynamics. I'm honoured to have them both on Let's Talk About Sects for this bonus episode today. Welcome to Let's Talk About Sects, a podcast about cults around the world. I'm your host, Sarah Steele. Before we start, a content warning. This episode deals with abuse and trauma, and also has a little bit of profanity. Please use your discretion as to whether this will be suitable for you and those around you who may be listening too. Now let's get straight into the interview.
Well, first of all, it's just such a pleasure to have you both on the show. I'm a huge fan of what you're doing, and I want to thank you for putting that out into the world. And so you've both taken your own experiences with a rather notorious cult, and you've used them to shine a light not only on other cultic groups, but culty behaviours across all different aspects of society. So I wondered whether it was clear to you as soon as you looked back on your experiences that these behaviours were to be found in so many different places, or did it take you a little while to notice this?
I think it started pretty quickly as soon as we started to recognise we were part of something bad. And somebody before us, actually Bonnie, Mark's wife, gave us a resource list of a bunch of movies. And we started with, was it Holy Hell we watched first, Nip?
Well, there were YouTube
about
videos
Buddhafield.
At first.
You had some YouTube videos, that, kind of jokey ones about, like, am I in a cult? And we were pretty floored with the description of what a cult actually is, which is not what we had been taught in Nexium of what a cult is. So once we saw the distinguishing factors on the checklist and how clearly we hit all of them, then we started to see it everywhere. And that's certainly been the journey of the podcast, I think, is like every single person we talk to across the board, whether it's a full-blown cult or something that's just a little bit culty, it's the thing, there's like such a consistent template of behaviors. But yeah, I think we pretty much saw it right away, and then it just snowballed. Isn't that right, Nip? Is that your
experience?
Yeah, I
mean, it kind of snowballed into at least the terms that we were using, the words we were using were abuses of power. And the reason I like that term is because a lot of the things that go inside these organizations that we call cults, the abuse of power that go inside of them are often going on in other organizations that you and I interact with every day. So I think starting to get sensitive to those in our situation allows us to have a lens to see it in other organizations as well. If it's not the same, it's a pretty similar flavor, or it rhymes with the behavior. So a lot of Sarah and I's conversations are about, like, does that feel culty? And does that feel a little bit But really what I think Sarah and I are talking about is like, is there abuse of power going on there? Mm. And I think that lens and way to reframe it and talk about it in that regard has been our lane and been what we're interested in speaking to.
Mm. Yeah, because I think so many people who haven't had a direct experience with a cult think that that sort of behavior is so sort of alien to their lives and they would never get wrapped up in it. But what you see is this sort of behavior happens in all kinds of aspects mm-hmm. of society. So every single one of us is susceptible to it and mm-hmm. we need to know how to recognize it.
And people like to think they're not susceptible to it.
It helps if you think you're not susceptible. It makes you feel protected, yeah. right?
Yes, exactly. And it's kind of an ego thing to think that you're not dumb enough or whatever, and you make it about intelligence, but there's a lot of conditions that could be going on at any time in your life that might make you susceptible to wanting to do a quote good thing, which leads you down the road that most of us, 99% of us, went down.
Yeah, that's right. And so with a little bit culty, what are some of the more surprising areas of society where you've found some cult-like tendencies operating that you've talked about?
Honestly, nothing really surprises me anymore. It's like, of course, like we got an email today about culty behaviors in the dance community and how dance has this whole culty underbelly and you know, academia is culty. And I mean, there's sort of like, you know, the obvious ones and almost every religion has a culty offshoot, if not the whole religion itself being culty. What's been the most surprising? I think, I don't really feel surprised. I'm like, well, of course, there it is too. Was there any that really shocked you?
I would love to add to that, but what I was going to say is nothing really surprises me anymore. After having so many conversations and living enough life, you know, you kind of, you know, my dad said he had a conversation with one of his friends in his field about what happened to me. And the guy said, was he sleeping with him? Did he want sex, power? And the fact that he was so quick to have a response to the description of my scenario told me that like he had seen it before. He's like, yeah, of course, mm-hmm. you know? And so these things don't really rear up. I mean, you know, they're in the news all the time. So I don't really get surprised per se. Surprise isn't the word I would use. I would say, I don't know, Sarah, what would you say?
I think if anything, it's just seeing like there's a school program at Waldorf that I don't know if it's in Australia. Take a look, you might want to do an episode on mm-hmm. it. A little bit culty, but like we had our son in it when we were leaving and there were just some of the things that were going on that I just felt uncomfortable with, but I couldn't place it. And then we left and we learned all these words to describe the abuses and like the tactics that the groups use. Mm-hmm. And I was able to name the things that were happening in the program. I don't think Waldorf is a cult per se, but there was
I don't think it's proprietary.
No, but there were just things about it in terms of the dogma and the rules and the sort of slightly hidden agenda. Like you think you're signing up for it's very natural. Everything's made out of wood. There's no plastic. It's a certain methodology of education that elements of it I really liked, but there's also this hidden kind of, I think we're going to do an episode on it.
I've just Googled it. So Waldorf in Australia is Steiner.
Same thing.
Yeah. And that's Rudolf Steiner, right?
Yeah.
And I do believe that he is a rather culty person if you look up his his background and his approach.
Mm. Yes.
Robert Evans did an episode for Behind the Bastards that I listened to, which was very enlightening.
I will add that to my to-do list because I've wanted to do one on Waldorf/Steiner for a while. Needless to say, we pulled Troy out of Waldorf, but I was like, I guess like Nippy's right. It's not surprise isn't the right word. It's more just, oh, there it is again. And can you believe it's there too?
I look for it now, you know, like even when, you know, Sarah and I were looking at schools, you know, I was like, Sarah, I'm not putting my kid into something that's dogmatic in this way. And I think I might be a little oversensitive to it because of our situation. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure because we happen to be living in pretty polarizing times right now. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to assess, but I'm sensitive to it. And I certainly will go make sure that what I'm sensitive to isn't going on.
Mm. And maybe it's worth being slightly oversensitive to that one.
I'll be that guy. That's kind of what I told Sarah. I was like, I'll be the guy that goes in there and make sure I don't have a problem with that.
We've kind of covered this a little bit already, but a lot of people tend to think that it's a certain type of naive and vulnerable person who ends up in a cult. And in some ways, the accomplished and impressive people who rose up the ranks of NXIVM really helped to dispel that myth. Mm-hmm. As we all know, nobody joins a cult. And I've come to understand anyone could end up in a coercive group. And those of us who are idealistic and looking to dedicate ourselves to something meaningful are sometimes most at risk of handing over power and control to the wrong guru. I'm wondering what warning signs from your personal experiences do you think we could educate others to look out for at the outset, and that might have helped you to think twice about the path that you were on before you got so far along it?
Great question, and also great lead-in, and I appreciate that. I think that certainly is a myth that is being dispelled in this new golden age of cult awareness. You know, look at us with our two cult podcasts talking about these things. But I think what is true about that myth is the naivete. And I, you know, even though I wasn't weak, I was my vulnerability was looking for community and purpose. And I think my idealism and me not knowing how cults operate put rose colored glasses on and overlooked a number of red flags right from the beginning. So I didn't, like, if I had watched The Vow, and this happens where people either, you know, watch The Vow or listen to the podcast or whatever, and then they get invited to something and they're like, I know what I'm looking at now because you taught us that is word salad and that is love bombing and that is, you know, there's very specific tactics. I didn't have any of that template and have any of that. My only understanding of cults was vaguely hearing about Jonestown and Waco. You know, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't happening. So when they presented something like sashes, and my gut instinct is, that's weird. Nippy always says, sashes, bowing, and Vanguard, you know, I'm out. But once you've paid $2,000 and the person you really trust is like, stick it out till day three and then it gets great. At least for me, I overrode a lot of red flags. And I certainly, part of my personal non-culty mission is to educate people on those red flags. And one of them is, you know, revering somebody. We were bowing to Vanguard and saying, thank you, Vanguard, in our 5-day, and I'd never even met him yet.
Mm.
And just the fact that everyone was idolizing him and putting him on such a pedestal, I felt uncomfortable. I didn't feel that was right, but then I'd also been instructed that we're going to feel uncomfortable, and that means there's something there to look at. Like, clearly I have an authority issue, right? So, and that would be another red flag. If they're telling people to not trust their, you know, trust their gut instincts, that their gut instincts are wrong because you have, in this case, an axiom is called a disintegration.
Mm.
Well, I have so many. Nippy, you jump in.
Yeah, I mean, it's a loaded question in a lot of ways because people go for various reasons. And each person has their own kind of story. Sarah hit a lot of it. If I was going to hit something a little bit differently, you know, I look at why I did it. I didn't trust the institutions that were in place to really do what they say to do. Mm-hmm. That's where I was in my life. And here's something that came along that was outlining an ethical platform that spoke to me and what I thought would address a lot of the problems of the world, and that was people working on themselves to become more ethical.
Mm-hmm.
Was I vulnerable and naive? Naive, yes. Wasn't particularly vulnerable at the time. Not that there would be anything wrong with that. If that were the reason to do it, I was more looking for like a mission and a purpose. Mm. And it outlined it in a pretty interesting way that I thought I hadn't heard in other institutions that had seemingly not been doing their job. So it got me in that kind of altruistic phase. And that's where I think I was naive, because the systems in place have been here for a long time. There's a lot of bad things about them and there's a lot of good things about them. And it's actually ironic that the systems in place were the things that we were able to use to put them away. So it's kind of a full circle story for me in that regard.
That's such an interesting point. And it's just, I don't even know what to say about it. It's sort of, ironic is probably the wrong word, but it's overused. Devastating though, that it's like, the you can see the breakdown of these systems that we have power structures in so many aspects, and that they're letting down the public, and that's all through corruption and abuses of power. Mm-hmm. And that's sending people into these other groups which are abusive as well. It's just this horrible cycle, isn't it?
Right.
And that actually happens a lot. The cult shaped the hashtag I Got Out movement that we're part of, just did a post about this, which is it's a not culty community for people recovering and trying to share their stories publicly to, you know, blow the lid off the shame that comes with recognizing, holy crap, I've been duped. But they just did a post about when you leave, you have this cult-shaped hole in yourself, in your heart, in your well-being, and then you go looking for something to fill the hole. And so it's a lot of people end up just joining another culty community or another, you know, so it's like going from one bad relationship to another, which is very common, right?
Mm, absolutely right. And I think that there's this wrong notion that people have that you get out of a cult and then you're free. Hooray, everything is wonderful. And it's just, there is so much more. I'm going to skip ahead because I have a question which was about, I'm really interested to know your thoughts about what our societies could be doing better to help protect people. But also I think this is more focused on to assist those who manage to exit, because I think so many people come out and there is that cult-shaped hole and there's nothing to fill it. And I wondered what would have really helped you in the aftermath, and what do you think might help others in that situation?
Well, we had a ton of help.
We were actually very supported.
How do I put this? You know, I tell Sarah this and anyone who asked this, we made a lot of really good decisions in a short amount of time that led to us not being in litigation for 5 to 10 years or whatever. And I think that had to do with a lot of the work that had already been done out there that was literally waiting for us in YouTube videos, books, in some cases, podcasts, documentaries, specifically Stephen Hassan's book and Yanya Lalich's book. You know, the first 30 to 60 pages, I was going through it going, holy shit, oh my God, this is what happened. And just getting a download of like, because I'm kind of idiot savant that way with statistics. and I just got a download of what I, you know, reconciling my delusion. Mm-hmm. And next thing you know, Sarah as well, we're kind of going through it together. And she got interviewed with Things in the Fall. I don't think I was really ready to get interviewed. I didn't really want to process my trauma on camera, but Sarah had to go out there and tell her story. So there's a lot of things that were going on for us in terms of we had to get in a fight and deal with reconciling our delusion. Mm. And it all happened really quickly, and it seemed like we got lucky. And I tell Sarah, our angel showed up when we needed him. Wouldn't you say, Sarah?
Now we believe in angels.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what we believe in.
Where I was a slave to the law of physics before any of this, but when you have kind of what I would call maybe a spiritual or dark light experience, it becomes pretty undeniable to you. So denying it would just be, you know, denying your own reality. So that's what I feel like happened.
Oh, it's great that you managed to find that support and that was there for you. That's really fantastic. I speak to a lot of people.
That was karma too.
Yeah, you had some owing
because we don't talk about this a lot, but Sarah and I were like the first ones in, last ones to go. You know, we were working pretty hard and we were actually helping people. Right. So it was possible to be.
We didn't start a harem.
Yeah. It was possible to be a part of an abusive regime and be doing some good work with some people and their goals. Mm. And so I tell Sarah it was that work that allowed us to have the good karma when we got out, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. You'd put in that work to build that karma.
I believe in
ourselves.
We dumped a lot of positive energy into the universe and I think we got it back when we needed it.
Yeah. Good.
I'm just trying to think if there's anything else. Like, I mean, I think it would be great to have government and, you know, I think we ended up being okay. Like our family supported us and I ended up, I went back to voiceover and, but if I hadn't had that, and I certainly know there's a lot of people that get out and they've lost their income, I've lost their community. And that's why actually a lot of people stay. Like, I'm sure you know this talking to Mormons and Jehovah's Witness, where like everything is in the community. And the thought of starting fresh is like, some people don't even know how to write their resume or CV because they've never had to. And it's like, you're really starting from scratch. So I think having, I don't know, some sort of, I don't know the terms, but some sort of assistance through either through the government or through, I mean, our goal is through the podcast and the Hashtag I Got Out is to provide something, some sort of scholarships or, you know, get back on your feet chunk of money. And also, like, you know, somebody hand, one of my goals is to be able to hand over a box of books and healing resources and like a business cards or like phone calls with therapists, because sometimes you just don't even know how to, where to start, yeah, how to find somebody.
I guess to trust. It starts like this too. Mm. I mean, you have to have these conversations and you have to, you want people to be approached by these things. And when they're approached by them, laugh at them, almost like an infomercial. You want someone like Keith Raniere, the future Keith Raniere, to open their mouths and people go, okay, buddy, you know, that's what you want, because
put it back in your pants.
Yeah. Just try, you know, but there's always going to be, you know, people that are going to be susceptible to it. And it depends how much you can reach that and get that kind of education in our systems. And, you know, I think people laugh at infomercials, but people still, you know, do it. Or whatever it is, you know, whatever the snake oil of the day is.
Yeah, and I think it's always important to remember that there are, you know, there are many people who are born into these groups and didn't make that choice to join. So
absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, that certainly doesn't mean not be sensitive to that.
It's tricky because that means in terms of education, how do you even reach those people? So, yeah, I just think there's an awful lot more we could be doing. But one thing is definitely, you know, talking about these things so openly so that there's less of a stigma attached, so that when people come out, hopefully they can avoid some of that shame and embarrassment, because people For sure. have more understanding of what they've been through and put the blame where it belongs rather than on
right.
the survivor.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it always boils down to some sort of empathy.
Mm. Mm. yeah.
It's what all our systems are missing a little bit right now.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah,
so.
In terms of leaving, people find the strength to leave these high control groups for all kinds of different reasons. And I have, you know, huge admiration for anyone who manages to do so. I think there's still a real underestimation of the dynamics that keep people entangled and make it really hard to get out. I often wonder whether if I were in that situation, would I have found the strength to do it? I have no idea. But when a group does implode and a leader ends up in prison, that can help a lot of followers see the error of their mm-hmm. ways. But in the case of Keith Raniere, he still has some pretty staunch devotees. And I wondered if you had any idea why some people can't come to terms with the reality of the situation in spite of everything that's come out in those court cases.
For every person, it's case by case.
Mm-hmm.
And the point I want to make on this is normally they don't have anything to go back to. And normally there's some sort of pride or ego aspect to it where they don't want to be seen as the kind of person who's dumb enough, because people make it about intelligence, to fall for this. So they're protecting their self-image. And there's nothing that they have to lose by doubling down on their self-image. So really their self-image is the only thing that they have left to save.
Mm-hmm.
Right? In certain cases, we have had a lot of conversations with people who left, who didn't really believe us at first and kind of trying to figure out what happened. They were in Mexico. And one person said, I didn't leave right away because I had family members in. And I had a lot to lose if I took the stand that you took, right? I still had to get my family out and I still had assets and resources. And so his response to the people that were still loyal is like, they just don't have anything to lose.
Mm.
They have nothing to weigh it with. They have nothing weighing against, like if they had a career to go back to or a family that, you know, they had to go back to or some sort of job, they would probably make the pivot and choose the more rational decision. But instead they double down because all they have left is they made this huge investment and it was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And you see it a lot in a lot of other domains, like buying a stock. People just don't want to sell the stock because they still think it's going up. So, you know, it's a tough place to be. They haven't even begun to do the work of reconciling what happened to them because they haven't admit anything's happened to them. And consequently, they deny that other people are going through abuses or are victims to Keith because they would have to admit they were as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a pivot they're not willing to make yet.
Mm-hmm.
And what about that other thing we learned recently, Nibby, about how, and this they use the example of with Heaven's Gate, how like when there's a doomsday prophecy and it doesn't happen, like some people leave, but a lot of people double down because they're, like it's you'd think that like if, when you look at this from a, I want to say sane's not the right word because I think I'm pretty sane and I got, you know, majorly messed with in my head. But like from a perspective of somebody not in a cult, you look at it and go, oh, when the leader's wrong about the world ending, then that's his time to get out. But there's this process where because of the shame, and especially if anyone's been in a group or their family or friends are saying you're in a cult, and then something like that happens, they have to wrap their, they have to do a bunch of mental gymnastics to say, well, they weren't wrong. They just, this is actually a test from God to see, like there's a, you know, they come up with all sorts of different reasons in that case. Like it's a test from God to see who would be loyal no matter what. And now we're even more dedicated to the leader and there's a new date for the end of the world and that kind of thing. So in that way, I see the, a lot of the people that stay loyal with Nexium is that if they were to really admit that failure, then they'd, it's such a huge, I don't even know if how they would deal with it because I know how it felt for me 5 years ago, right? We've been out for 5 years. Right. And then there's a bonding in that. And a lot of the people that stay, they don't really have, as like to be said, but they only have each other. And there's a right. bonding in that sort of like, we're the last ones standing and we are the only ones. And then also you have to remember the indoctrination specifically of the curriculum, which was so manipulative, which is basically like your commitment to never get off the path was the only thing you had. Your word was your commitment. Your commitment was your power. Anyone who got off the path, and by the path, I mean the straight path or the commitment to your growth through Nexium with your dedication to Keith Runeri at the top, if you got off that path, you were weak. You would never work through your issues and you would essentially perish. You know, so it's not like in some religious cults, it's you're going to die and God will smite you and or you'll be blinded and or you'll literally they say you'll die of cancer on the streets. But this is a deep attack on one's internal character. And they believe that they will be the ones to fight to him. And that was, you remember Nippy and part of the question in the curriculum, there was like, what would you die for? Would you die for anything? What are your principles? And if you didn't have that, you were like not really principled. So they believe they are the most principled to stand up against the people who are doing a smear campaign against them.
Yeah, I don't think they believe that anymore, though.
I don't know what they believe. I could just go from what I've learned about this process. But I do think some of them believe that.
In terms of like, normally the people who are most abused and humiliated are the ones that are going to have the hardest time reconciling their delusion.
Uh-huh. Oh, there's that component too.
Unless they have an incentive to do it.
I mean, some of those qualities, when you mention them, they in other contexts are really such wonderful qualities, that sense of dedication and, you know.
Yeah. He leveraged nobility, vulnerability, and people's principles. It's called moral abuse. It's in Janja Lalich's book. It was like number 8 of the 14. I just looked at that and went, oh, that's mine. So it's a hard one because you think, I believed I was doing something good while aligned with someone who was doing abusive behaviors. It was a tough pill for me to swallow. And I was arrogant about it too. I was arrogant. I had like the best model and I was good. And then what we're doing was good. Right. So it was just, you know, I had egg in my face.
Yeah. Yeah. Such a hard thing to be able to turn around and come to terms with.
But and once you do, you get the wisdom and you get the lessons and you don't do it again. That's the journey, I guess, right? I don't know.
And as you say, there is a really, really supportive community out there that would welcome anyone with open arms who comes out of that experience, right?
I hope so. Yeah.
I wondered if you could tell me about an aspect that you think the general public and perhaps also the authorities in terms of maybe police and prosecutors tend to misunderstand about cults and how they operate.
Oh, that is a good question.
Well, I think it's changing. I'm not going to say our case is the catalyst, but I think it's safe to say, when we say Sarah, that it's close to it. In large part because you've seen a lot of similar cases happen since and the perpetrators be held accountable. And also some of the language in those court cases is language taken from the Nexium trial. So I think, you know, law enforcement is getting crash course in a lot of ways, and getting educated, at least in the United States. You know, I don't know that our court case, our case would have been handled and done in the way in many other countries, because you were up against Bronfman money, against the Department of Justice. And I would venture to say that Bronfman money carries a little more weight than maybe a Canada or a Britain or I don't know. So I don't know. And to think that it would happen so quickly in under a year or two, I'd say law enforcement is onto it and has a template to use.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah. Sarah, sorry, you go ahead.
Oh, yeah, just specifically, and I'm sure you could speak to this even better than we could with your experience, but just the concept of coercive control.
You know, yeah, that's, for sure, for sure.
That's something that may be filtering into the system now, but I don't know if like a police officer showing up at a compound or a farm or a yoga studio would know what they're looking at. You know what I mean? Like when I went to the FBI and tried to explain the branding, I mean, the look on the guy's face, it truly was like, but you consented to it? Like, you know, like he couldn't wrap his head around it. So I think that there needs to be training certainly around how that process works and why it happens and what it looks like.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I'm thinking often about people who come out of groups that are, you know, there's not some huge crime that's being committed. In my mind, there is a crime that's being committed, but in many places, sure, it's not recognized as a crime. But yet you've got people coming out with huge amounts of trauma who are trying to rebuild an entire life, and they have nothing to, you know, they go to the police and the police say, well, you chose to be there. And it's like, well, there's still a real kind of gap in the understanding there. And coercive control is the key, as far as I can tell. But many of the laws being discussed are really only around coercive control in terms of a one-on-one domestic abuse right. situation. So recognizing it in a larger, broader context, I think, is important.
So I don't know if you recall the story of Elizabeth Smart, who was kidnapped in Utah, right, in the 90s as a teenager. And I think she was with him for years. And when the police found her, like, she couldn't express that it was her. They were asking her, is this you? And she'd been so trained to say it wasn't. And that it, also in her mind, if she did, her family was going to die. Mm. Because that's what he'd said. He said, if you ever tell anyone that who you are, I'll kill you and your family. So like that's, so I just, that's another whole other level of coercive control of what a victim might look like who's in the grasp or who's in the grips of a predator or a sociopath or, you know, any of these leaders.
Yeah. And I hope you're right that the kind of the NXIVM case and everything that's come to light has helped authorities to understand that situation more, because to think how hard it must have been to explain that sort of branding situation and then to be faced with someone who you really have to explain it to in such an intense way. The other thing I think about a lot is it can be quite hard to find a therapist who has the right understanding of cults. And so a lot of people I speak to, they've gone to someone and they've tried to explain what happened, and you pour it all of this out onto a therapist and then they just don't get it. And then you have to do again with the right person.
Mm. Yeah. We talk a lot about that on our podcast is, you know, finding, and I actually have that, by the way, if your listeners are interested, on my website, sarahedmondson.com/resources are a lot of the books we recommend and the movies, but also some therapists that we think are good in this area.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Make sure to include a link in the show notes as well, so people can find that really easily. Okay. So I have a bit of a specific question, but Let's Talk About Sex listener was really excited to hear I'd be speaking with you. And he's been, I think he did a PhD on Asimov. And he wondered whether Keith Raniere ever talked about Isaac Asimov or his foundation novels at NXIVM. Yeah,
I got this one, Sarah.
Yeah, go for it.
I actually heard him say this. The whole concept of NXIVM, which actually when I first took it was only executive success programs. So this is when this was said to me, is that Keith read the Isaac Asimov's foundation book. And I think there's a series of them and came up with the ESP curriculum right after he read it, which is bullshit, by the way. But it was a way of him aligning himself with that kind of mind. And I went and read The Foundation, and it was, which is pretty fascinating book, and was like, oh, I see what he's coming up with. He's answering the questions that humanity needs to ask in order to move forward and all that. And he's getting people to think about it. That's what I thought. That's uh-huh. what I inferred from it. So that was the kind of, when they're building the myth of Keith around the organization, you know, 240 IQ, it's like, yeah, he read these books, The Foundation, he was like 14 or whatever he was, and then immediately came up with the curriculum.
Mm, interesting. I'm sure that listener will be interested to hear that. I think yeah. he had a theory that the ideas around psychohistory, or which is around mathematically predicting human behavior, which was a yeah, part of this foundation series. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that it was actually quite problematic as a process and could result in basically authoritarian type structures. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, when you think about it, I know Sarah to behave a certain way in certain situations. So mm-hmm. in a lot of ways, I'm familiar with her, quote, algorithm, which you might call her behavior. If you have a curriculum that's eliciting your belief systems and you're remembering them and you're using them to abuse people, like, you know exactly how they're going to behave if that's why you're eliciting those belief systems from them. So my algorithm of Sarah would become more refined to the point where I can maybe control her because I understand all her weaknesses and all that.
Ah, that's what you're doing to me.
That's what the curriculum does, right? And so, well, I mean, fundamentally, like, you know, we're not psychologists, Sarah, right? And so when people tend to put out a persona, whether we buy it or not, we interact with it, right? It isn't until they do a behavior that seems a little untrustworthy or whatever that we kind of go, what are they up to? Well, we learned to figure out what people were up to, and in order to help them, he did it so he could control them and abuse them and use them in whatever way that he did, and said it's for the foundation and built this whole lore about how he was a humanitarian. It's bullshit. Mm. So that was the con. So we thought we were just doing, you know, kind of the Lord's work by helping people. But I don't particularly care what people think, you know, unless they want to volunteer it. And it's a agreed upon conversation, if that makes sense. Right.
Uh-huh.
So it's,
and just to be clear, the Lord's work, we're just using that.
That's it's metaphorical. Yeah. It's a metaphor.
We never metaphor. Said that. Yeah.
No, I'm not. In fact, that's probably one of the first times I've ever said that. But maybe it's a bad choice of words. I don't know.
Well, but it is true. Even though it wasn't religious, it felt like we were doing the most important thing is another way of saying it, right?
Yeah, and it's all higher purpose, right?
And if we really were, Sarah, then, we might still be doing it. But we found out we weren't. And we found one way to not do it.
Uh-huh. I feel like the word bullshit has come up a couple of times in your responses here, so I'm not sure if
sorry.
No, it's absolutely fine. Not a problem at all. I just wonder if this is a predictor of the answer to my next question, which I always am interested to know from people who've had direct experience in a cult about their leader. And so I'd love your perspective on is how much do you think Keith Raniere really believed in what he taught, and how much do you think it was just about power and control and manipulation of people to get what he wanted?
All power and control, period. There's not an altruistic bone in his body. I think he's a psychopath. I think he has a disdain for humanity rather than a love for it, because there's no way you would be able to do what he did to people and call him a humanitarian. He is the single kind of person that humanity needs to look out for, because they don't have a conscience. Mm-hmm. They do not care. There is no off switch, and they will steamroll over anyone. And their capacity to spit out lie after lie after lie is staggering. It's a scary person. People need to figure out what those people look and sound like.
And I guess there's also an element of, because of that real narcissism, like, is there a chance that he just believed that he deserved all of the, you know, the people to be slaves to him because he was just.
So I'm going to answer that the way Dan Shaw, who's a guy that helped us when we got out. We have, because those kinds of people have never subjected themselves to analysis, we can't really say for sure. Mm-hmm. So I can't really say for sure. What I do believe in some of, like, the memes and the things that you see about these kinds of people is that they thrive on that, and that is kind of their drug.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so their capacity, and he's even described it in The Psychopath's Way, the longer he can hold off the payoff of your pain, and he's compared it to an orgasm, the better the payoff when the destruction happens.
Oh, that's giving me goosebumps.
I know. Yeah.
This is stuff that he was describing how to look for other people that were psychopaths while describing himself.
He taught us this methodology as if there were people in the world who do this and this is what to look for. And he described it how, like, if you're pissed at, say, your neighbor for getting the promotion that you didn't or whatever, or they have a nicer car or whatever, something you're jealous of, in a moment you could go, like, key their car and that would feel good for a second. But a sociopath would slowly poison the neighbor's dog over a period of 6 months, for example, and know that it's coming. So, like, we know this now. Like,
life making your dog's, you know, happy. He knows that your destruction's coming.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fucked up psychology. It's like, it's hard to get. And what makes people susceptible to it is, I would never think that he's doing that. You would never think that he's doing that. Right. Sorry, Sarah, I cut you off.
No, that's it. Just sharing how, you know, And there's women around him who died from
all you have to do is look at his wake.
All so many women around him had cancer, and there was, you know, talk of how he thought that the water was being poisoned. Who do you think poisoned the water?
He has path of destruction. Yeah. His life is, and you have to figure. And I wrote this, I think, in the letter to the president of the company. Right after this happened, is like, where is this going? You know, the physical branding of his initials on people is a physical manifestation of a lot of emotional abuse for someone to get to that stage.
Mm.
And I said something to the effect of, this is an algorithm, or if this is, you extrapolate this over the next couple of years, how do you level up from putting your initials on someone? Like, what's the next step? And he has this itch that he can't scratch. He's just going to keep up in the ante and up in the humiliation to the people that are following him to ensure their loyalty. Because if they leave, they have to admit they did these humiliating things to themselves. So he has a lot of leverage and a lot of coercive power over these people still. And it's just dangerous. And had it not manifested in a physical form, it's very hard to quantify and hold these people accountable. And they're out there in their positions of power. So, you know, those are optics for you.
And I just always want to ask, like, what can we do to stop these people? But it always just always, kind of tends to come back to
education.
Yep. Educating, right?
Yeah.
And that really comes back to what you're doing with the podcast. I think it's fantastic that you've harnessed your experiences to try and put this out in the world and educate more people. So I really want to congratulate you on the work
you've been doing.
Of course. And the topics you explore, I think they're really, really interesting. You've had some incredible guests and you've covered such important ground. So I wondered, what can your listeners expect next?
You know, season 5, which drops in the fall, we've recorded almost half of it already and we have some incredible guests. We had a fascinating conversation. Going to be controversial in this space with Eckhart Tolle about toxic spirituality and, you know, how to look for a leader that's not a con man. Wonderful, probably my favorite ever, although toss up with Eckhart, a 2-hour podcast interview with Evan Rachel Wood about her experience in Hollywood with Marilyn Manson, which was emotional, riveting, intense, beautiful, cathartic. Very, very, very excited about that. An hour with Dr. Ramani, narcissist expert, who's wildly...
She's great.
She just knows so much about the topic. But season 5 will maybe be a little bit different. We're definitely going to keep going with survivor stories, but also balancing it with experts, just partly for our own sanity. And we are taking a break for the summer because we're moving to Atlanta and just needing to be normal humans and parents also. But we're really excited for season 5. Our listenership and the people who find us, send us, I'm sure they do this for you too, Sarah, send suggestions of what to cover almost daily. And I'm really excited about doing this with you. And if we can collaborate in any way and support each other, it's so important. Like everyone doing in this space in terms of shining light and educating, I do think, to answer your earlier question, does encourage people to keep speaking. And I think that's why these groups have existed for so long, because people have left cults since cults existed, but nobody talked about it because they were so embarrassed. And I one thing I love about being public about my experience is that people share with me, and they'd be like all the time, either in person, literally stop us on the street. Mm-hmm. Maybe I forgot to tell you this happened yesterday at the folk festival where I was in Vancouver, but people stop us and they say they hadn't told anybody that they were in a cult or a cult-like mm-hmm. group or in a course of control dynamic. But because of the podcast, they were able to, you know, share it, own it, write about it, talk about it. And I think that's what stops these people, is that the more we talk and share, we know what the red flags look like and we don't make the same mistakes ever again. Yeah. And that just trickles down, hopefully, till these guys, like Nippy said, will just get laughed at when they invite them to their, you know, oasis or business opportunity or ranch. Whatever, I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I mean, just I always say, like, all credit to all of the people who've spoken with me for the podcast and shared their stories, because my understanding about the whole thing comes from all of those survivors, and I'm so impressed by all of them. And there are such incredible, wonderful people who've had these experiences. I think it's not for everyone to be able to talk about it. Sometimes there's too much trauma and, you mm-hmm. know, no pressure on those people whatsoever. But for those who do, I think it's really helping that understanding in the world. I think even just in the time that I've been doing the podcast, there's just such an increased understanding about the dynamics. The coverage, even in mainstream media, I think has been improving. It used to be all just really sensationalist stuff.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think that's really fantastic to see. And those guests sound amazing, so I can't wait to listen mm-hmm. to the season 5. But yeah, you definitely need to take some time off in the meantime. That's important to take some time out.
Nippy, did I miss anything about what people can look forward to?
Merch.
Oh, we have merch coming. That's exciting. We're on Instagram. I don't know. New website.
No, I think you covered it.
Okay. By the way, you're in Australia, and an article that I was just a part of with Stephen Hassan, some other people, just came out in, I don't even know what this paper is. In
Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, I think, the Fairfax Media. It's
The Age.
Excellent.
The Age.
Excellent article.
Did you
article.
See it?
I have. I read that. I read that article. It was really, really good. Like, that's an example.
Yeah, it was good.
Very impressed.
It was good.
Yeah. And that's
Sharon Groch, or Groch, I don't know how to say her name, like, really good journalist. I was very impressed.
Yeah, and it has length and it really gets into the detail. And I just thought that's exactly the kind of coverage that I hope we're moving more towards. And
it was
good to see you interviewed for that one, for sure.
Yeah, I'm so excited about that, because that's the kind of thing that somebody who may not have HBO or watch The Vow, you know, or have listened to our podcast, might read that article and go, oh, I don't know that about cults.
Yeah,
you know, that's such a win, I think.
Yeah,
that type of media, like, you got to hit all the different mediums.
Yeah,
it's also to have the people interviewing you not tacitly judging you.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. And not having the preconceived notions and ideas of what they're trying to say.
People think they can hide that, but they just can't, and it actually comes out in their questioning too.
Yeah, I bet.
Well, however many years we've been doing it, you can kind of sit down and go, okay, I'm going to have to inform this person a little bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we've got to back up. We've got to lay a foundation. We didn't have to do that with you.
Well, I think that's what we're doing. We're informing. You know, Sarah, when I played that JFK Kennedy clip for Sarah a couple of weeks ago. And what was so great about him and Martin Luther King in that era is that they were leaders that were informing you. They are trying to give you information to make informed decisions for your lives. And it's a very powerful thing if you're seemingly not doing it for yourself, and you're actually taking your story, your wisdom, and you're gift wrapping it to people so they can make informed decisions. It's a really powerful thing to do, and a great way to spend your time, I think. So if you can do it and hang a shingle while you're doing it.
Well,
it's great.
And it seems like you found a real way to harness that passion for trying to make a difference in the world in this new way, and it's really fantastic.
Yeah.
Aw, thank you.
Well, that's
we're adding to it.
Yeah,
that's the way I look at it.
Yeah, you know? it's a big conversation. Yeah. There's a lot of people doing a lot of amazing work. Yeah. I hear, Sarah, you did the audiobook for Janja Lalić.
Yeah, that book was so helpful to me, but I also had a hard time reading, which was just part of my PTSD.
Mm.
But I could listen. I could listen and walk, but I couldn't sit down and read. Sitting still is hard. Still is hard for me, as Nippy can attest to. And I basically kept harassing her. I said, listen, you need an audio book for people like me. And basically gave myself a job and recorded it, which was a wild process because I had to read it again and read it without crying. And yeah, many paragraphs I had to read multiple times, but it's such a good book. It's my, the thing probably I recommend the most, that and Combating Cult Mind Control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. She's absolutely amazing. I have just put out a book myself, and she gave me a little endorsement. It was really, she's fantastic of her. And then I just recorded, it's called Do As I Say, How Cults Ooh. Control, Why We Join Them, and What They Teach Us About Bullying, Abuse, and Coercion. And I just recorded the audiobook. It was like a 4-day process. And I don't know how you do that. That was so hard.
It's really hard. Dude. I've only done two. I've done her book and my book. And it's really difficult. And I'm a voiceover actor. And
yeah.
It's really difficult. So, but maybe we should have you on our podcast and we can talk to you about your book.
Oh,
let's do it.
That would be amazing. Let's do it. That would be amazing.
Yeah, you can be one of our experts.
I really shy away from the word expert. It's like,
so do I, actually. It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
say I have a story.
Yes, but you'll technically be one because you wrote a book. But
yeah, I think I have to embrace it.
You have to embrace it. You have to embrace it. And we'll be in Atlanta, and that might be easier with the time zones, or maybe harder. I don't even know, but we'll figure it out.
Oh, I see how you're doing. Well, good luck with the move. Before we finish up, though, is there anything that we haven't covered that you wanted to talk about?
I mean, again, just a plug for hashtag I Got Out for that community. If there's any listeners who want to dial into that, and there's some like free writing workshops with Jurette Bouillon, who also wrote another great book called The Everyday Cult. She was someone we interviewed on our podcast. I love that community. And I love the community that's formed in, you know, on social media through our pod. I invite people to join and check it out, and not in a culty way, in a educational way.
Where are the best places for them to find you?
I would say a little bit culty on Instagram, or myself, Sarah Edmondson on Instagram. Nippy's at Anthony Ames 11 at Instagram. We're on Twitter, but we're just getting geared up.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting geared up for TikTok and YouTube, like all that stuff. We have to hire people because we're just so old, is what it is.
We have two kids too.
We're old and we have two kids. We're like
and we
senior
don't go around
citizens
twerking about our cult, Sarah.
No, we left that. We left the twerking for some other people who shall remain nameless.
Anyway,
well, fantastic. All those links will be in the show notes. And just thank you both so much for your time today and for the work that you're doing.
Absolute thanks to the pleasure. Sarahs.
Thank you. Yeah, Team Sarahs and the Nippy.
Thanks so much for listening, and you can find links to A Little Bit Culty and Sarah and Nippy's social media channels and other resources in the show notes. If you've been personally affected by involvement in a cult or would like to support those who have been, you can find support or donate to Cult Information and Family Support if you're in Australia via CIFS.org.au. And you can find resources outside of Australia with the International Cultic Studies Association via icsahome.com. Let's Talk About Sects is produced and presented by me, Sarah Steele. Sound design and music is by Joe Gould. This bonus episode was edited by Matt Brazel. My thanks to Sarah Edmondson and Anthony Nippy Ames for speaking with me. You can access ad-free episodes and support the production of this independent podcast via Patreon, patreon.com/LTASpod, or with a one-off donation or merch purchase. Season 5 of the show is shaping up to be a great one and will launch in September. Until then, thanks for listening, and I'll catch you again soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.